Candy Graham.
Knock knock.
Why the long face? I don't know. how's it going?
There's momentum in a forward direction.
I was going to say, is it propelling you in any particular direction today?
It's a direction. It's more or less forwards. Yeah, can't ask for too much.
Did you say forward or forwards? I think there's a difference, but I don't know.
Oh, I haven't really put any thought into that. I think I just said forwards.
Yeah, no, but, I feel like there's actually a difference between them, but I don't know what it is. It's like toward and towards, I think, has a more specific difference.
Is it untoward or untowards?
I don't know. It's anyway and anyways, and I never say anyways because I'm pretty sure that's not a word. But you know, all of these words,
all the great words. So, you know, yep. Hi.
You know what's an important word?
Squad.
I was gonna say the.
Oh yes,
because you just throw that in front of something else, and then boom, you're taxonomically distinct.
Well, it is it's a definite article. I was actually talking to internet famous Paul. Paul Sabourin or Paul, whatever.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Musician Paul, from the musical duo of his hit Someone Else and Paul. As you can tell, I'm not a super huge fan. He was talking about a lot of properties drop the definitive article these days in order to like sound cool. And I said it actually kind of tripped me up with the television show I was watching recently called The White Lotus, because I kept wanting to call it White Lotus. And when I was colloquially like having a conversation with someone about it, it would be White Lotus. But it is The White Lotus. So presumably it is the sequel to a movie called White Lotus that existed before it, and they only kept some of the characters.
And they swept it under the rug, and now The White Lotus is the reboot with some new fun Marvel energy.
Is it new? Is it fun? Is it Marvel energy?
It is not. And I was thinking about this a little bit earlier, and maybe... Like, I will preface this whole conversation with the word version of my tweet from yesterday, which was that I was very tired. I had a very long day of work. It was exhausting. And then I tried to watch The Suicide Squad so we could talk about it today. And nearly the entire movie, I was just staring. I was just glaring. Like, why? Why are you doing this to me, TV, that I set to play this imagery in front of me? Why must I suffer these fools? So I was in a bit of a, I don't know, I wasn't in a bad mood, but I was just like, I had no time to suffer the fools that were on my screen. And because of that, I didn't have the greatest experience. But, you know, this movie, and I guess this whole franchise, just kind of reminds me of the days, like the early X-Men movies, where superhero movies didn't really know what they were doing, and they were very forgettable because they just didn't really make an impact. But now they've got cooler, flashier effects and quippy lines because everyone saw that one Joss Whedon one.
You know, Joss Whedon did actually come about as a point of reference when I was thinking about my thoughts on this movie. And for those listening at home, we are going to talk about all the spoilers for this movie that was recently released, and if you are in any way hoping to be surprised by it, you can tune out now. But I don't feel like it is worth your time and energy. It is actually quite a long movie. At 132 minutes, I feel like it should have not been this long. And I think that is also another sign of the sort of indulgence of these things. But yeah, Joss Whedon came up as a sort of point of reference because there's a lot of that 90s Gen X, like, ironic, insincere stuff in here, where there's sort of a meta commentary of this postmodern breakdown of the medium of like, hey, look at me making a joke about how silly it is to do this thing by having the characters be expendable in a certain way. And I feel like that does the movie a disservice, and does the other characters we theoretically should care about a disservice. And it occurs right off the bat. They sort of hit the ground running with that irreverence for itself, which I think undercuts any future character building you're trying to do inside of the film, because you are just you keep calling back to the like, at any moment something's just gonna like kill one character on screen, and you will have no way of seeing it coming or predictability or anything, and then their storyline just ends, and oh well, isn't that funny, like people just die, lol. And it kind of ruins sort of the trajectory of a lot of the stuff that's going on. Whereas in the first movie, I would say I have different problems with it than this movie. that one, they tried to like bolt on humor, like sort of after the fact, to punch it up to be something else.
That one clearly suffered from production issues, and it shows in the final product. Whereas this one, it looks like they were given the world on a platter, and this is what they chose to do with it.
Yeah, like this is, for better or worse, very purposefully architected by James Gunn, and he is a somewhat controversial director and writer, because of infamously he had a bunch of old tweets where he was trying to be like a sort of shock comedian guy and saying like wild things you shouldn't say. And he regretted that, mostly because some, people who were, up to no good, were trying to like dig up dirt on him and, get him fired from his job because they just didn't like him.
But halfway through watching this movie, I thought to myself, is James Gunn okay? Because he starts the movie by murdering an innocent bird. And then later in the movie, he sets a bunch of innocent birds on fire. And then there is just, I mean, there's probably a better word for it than gratuitous, but that's probably the most accurate word. There's just gratuitous gore left and right. Like, we can do all kinds of things with special effects and not really have to tear the faces off people. But, you know, who could resist seeing Pete Davidson catch a rifle round right in the face live without cutting away? Like, why not?
Best use of Pete Davidson in a movie so far.
I don't have a problem with Pete Davidson, to be honest, but
I deeply dislike him.
he's tall, though.
Is he?
I think so. Yeah, there's a lot of gore in this movie, and it seems like James Gunn was like, finally, the shackles of the Marvel franchise are removed from me, and I can do all of the horrible things to my characters that I want. So I'm really gonna go for it in very creative and interesting ways. And I don't know about you, but I wouldn't say the gore is too much. Like, oh God, I had to turn away, but I did not gain anything from it.
He's the same height as me.
Pete Davidson?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
6'3". So
he carries it very awkwardly.
Yeah. But so, anyway, I think there is some of that reactionary element to it of, let me do the things that are un-Marvel in this movie, because it doesn't need to conform to that ethos, that vibe, that whole thing, because over here Warner Brothers is just run by random number generators and you can just do whatever, and it'll
spin
either
the wheel
pass or fail
and make yourself a DC movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's like playing the lottery, really. But the reason why he was doing this DC movie is because he was fired from his Marvel job because of his old tweets, and that were dug up and used against him, and he apologized for, but it was too late. I think it was Alan Horn, I want to say, who was running stuff at Disney Pictures at the time. Like, not even Kevin Feige. This is above him. He was just like, screw this guy. I don't want anything to do with him. And so he was removed. And then James Gunn started this process of working on this, let's say, troubled. This is a troubled production because, like I said, Warner Brothers random number generators had gone through several writers and directors at this point in the development cycle because they wanted to greenlight a movie after the first Suicide Squad was released, or before it was even released. And David Ayer had turned it down, like we talked about, in order to do Gotham Sirens, which as far as I can tell, is going zero places. Instead, it went to a few other directors who all kind of got stuck in development hell and couldn't pull anything off that the studio wanted to greenlight. But then when James Gunn was available, DC Warner Brothers gave him carte blanche to do whatever, which was a different approach than what they were doing with the other directors that they were just letting spin their wheels in the mud. And
he got Cate Blanchett with the budget.
Yeah. And so he was able to do whatever it is that he wanted to do. And he didn't have the studio second guessing him in the ways that the other directors who were stuck in development hell did. And for better or worse, you wind up with this product, which is this sort of reaction. I would say, like, you know, this isn't, he's not reacting against the David Ayer movie, which is interesting, because usually if you have a director come into a property and they try to make it their own, they really want to, like, sever any and all connection with the previous thing in order to, like, give it, like, a clean break. This is, you know, this isn't your daddy's Suicide Squad. This is, like something new. Assuming
your daddy, who's 3 years older than you are.
Yes. They grew up so fast. But he sort of, like, and then he carefully tried to tread this, where he was saying, like, I didn't want to make a sequel, and at the same time, I didn't want to do anything that would disagree with the previous film. So he carries over some stuff, he interfaces with a few things, but it's not in dialogue with the previous movie. And I think that is a benefit, but also much to this film's detriment, because there is no character building that spans any of the movies that these characters have been in. And some of these characters have been in multiple movies at this point, because Rick Flagg was in the first one and had a more substantial role than he has in this film. There is nothing that builds on anything that has to do with his character from the other one. He is almost sort of a new person. You just have a familiarity with the fact that he was there before.
What are you talking about? He has that incredibly motivated change of heart towards the latter half of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, and again, spoiler alert, Rick Flagg was willing to do whatever it takes for America and for the mission and for rah, 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 go us.
He's a soldier, man, yeah. Even though he wears a yellow t-shirt through most of the movie, because I guess he got sand in his fatigues.
Yeah, well, and he's in the first film, he's very committed to the cause. And in this film, he's not committed to this cause. In fact, he is at odds with another character who's brought in who is committed to this cause. And so it's not commented on or put into dialogue with anything that he said or did in the previous film. And he doesn't bring up anything about how following orders worked out differently in the past and how he can't follow these orders right now because of reasons. He doesn't mention the villain of the first movie was his girlfriend, who was possessed by an interdimensional witch's spirit. And she is not brought up at all. Does June Moon exist anymore? No one knows. It seems like it would be relevant to him and his regrets and his thoughts and feelings towards the end of his life. But it is not commented on or brought up in the slightest.
Yeah, it would have been useful for him to relay some sort of personal learnings from the first film in his switch from doing what the country says to knowing when to break from your higher ups, because experimenting on innocent people, including children, is immoral and horrible. Which, yeah. So he yells what and then snaps, and then he's a different person, and he pulls a hard drive out of a little cubby, which is how hard drives are attached to servers for sure. And then he fights John Cena for about 15 minutes.
Yeah, I really love that little laptop hard drive, because it's one of those, like, little 2.5-inch ones.
He just reaches inside of a hole in the front of, like, a 70s-style, not even server, just, like, a switchboard.
Well, it's like, just, yeah. it's a rack. It's a rack of gear, like various pieces of gear. And then he would know that this was where all the data was stored.
No, he starts shaking it too. Like, yeah. He doesn't know what he's looking for.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a pachinko machine. I don't understand what necessarily was going on.
It was like a vending machine?
Yeah.
Like, he shook the hard drive loose in the top and it fell down out the bottom hole?
Yeah, he's like, give me my Mr. Pibb. So, I just don't think that they did, sir. They didn't do a good job with his character, because he's not a character. He is a plot device here.
He did get a couple of like quieter-ish moments in this movie, especially compared to the last movie, where he kind of sort of got a chance to. I'm not going to say he's good, because we had this conversation last time, but there was a moment where I was watching and I was like, wow, look at you, Joel Kinnaman, you're acting right now.
Yeah. Well, he's also had some complicated stuff come up at the time of the release of this film that we haven't commented on.
That's right.
Yeah, he has some. We will not comment on them, because I don't know what twists and turns that will take at this particular juncture. But we got to
make sure our podcast is evergreen.
Oh yeah, just like it was last week when we talked about how Birds of Prey wasn't going to have a sequel because it went nowhere, and that now it's going to have a sequel, but it's going to be basically direct to video because it'll be an HBO Max movie. Starring only Journey Smollett's Black Canary character, which, as we both agreed on, was basically the better of the characters in the last film beside Harley. Speaking of Harley.
And then for the record, to put that in the podcast, that came out, what, the day after our podcast?
Yeah.
The announcement.
Yeah. So presumably there will be some news about the characters of the Suicide Squad that will come out tomorrow. Speaking of Harley, she is here. They just kind of drop her in, and it is believable that she would be caught again and just kind of going along with it because she's sort of loopy and flaky and whatever. But at the same time, because of that, there is no character building on anything from the first film or from Birds of Prey. So she's actually had multiple films that she's been in as a character, and this movie makes no attempt sort of connect that stuff.
She's already been in two movies. What kind of development and character growth do you need? Like, can't the character stop growing at some point?
No, I mean, yeah, she should just be a warrior Barbie. But
she's a crazy combat lady in the beginning, and then she gets a red dress and some combat boots, and then she has a golden javelin and fights.
Yeah, but she does have a moment where she comments on the fact that she used to date guys, and now she doesn't date these kinds of guys anymore because, you know, she stops herself at the first sign there's a red flag, and she promised herself she would kill him. And, like, that is a funny moment, but it is a mere, like, tiny fraction of a moment in this film that has almost nothing to do with anything else. And the rest of the time, she's jumping and running and shooting and hurling things. And it isn't character driven.
I feel like there's a version of this movie where if you cut the fights down to just like, you know, the first punch, last punch, that this movie is, I don't know, hour, 20 minutes.
Yeah. I feel like, unfortunately, as we've commented on, the sort of reactionary element of this to sort of Marvel, the freed up ability to make this movie like this, apparently James Gunn went to Warner and said he wanted this to be R-rated, and they reluctantly agreed to do it. And that was a huge mistake, because I feel like the gore and the violence is not in service of anything in particular in this film other than the director being able to exercise putting in as much gore and violence and unique ways of killing people as he can sort of envision. And that is not appealing to me as an audience member. I can understand, like, you don't want to have, like, the same sort of cliche things, like, villain is, you know, hanging on the ledge and then, you know, falls off, whatever. Seen it a bunch of times. So you don't want to do that. So let's just slice them open. Let's stick a starfish on their face. Let's blow them up. Let's blow up their head. Let's blow up their arm.
You could cut, like, the last, like, 12 frames off of, like, 50 shots and get this down to a PG-13.
Yeah, there's just a lot of it where it's just like, well, they fired this shot and it hit this person. Now let's watch this person slowly blow up. And it's like, but why? Why do we need to do that? I mean, you said, and I agree, it's gratuitous. Like, and it does take away time and energy, I feel like. And energy, I think, is the important part, where it's not just the fact that you're dwelling on this, but it's also, you spend so much time sort of being numbed to this level of violence that if a character says or does anything that isn't violence, then you're not invested in whatever's going on.
Well, it's really showing the contrast between, you know, the government sending these people out to die for their country and how the reckless disregard for their safety and their lives juxtaposed with, you know, the orders of the safe people back in the office and, you know, just what the, how the country uses them up, man. And, you know, for, they get nothing out of it or whatever, because look how brutal life is. And then they're just bossing them around over the radio.
Yeah. Well, and that's another thing that goes uncommented upon, because we find out the big twist, at the very end of this, well, not the very end, but the climax of the film, is that, this was a government funded project all along. And that the only reason why they're going in to blow it up is because the government changed, the government that had oversight over this US government project, that government changed. And so they want to destroy all evidence of it being a US government project. And because of that, it has this element where it ties into the first film, but no one mentions or talks about it, because in the first film, the villain of it is a byproduct of Amanda Waller's quest to have this control, this power, this squad, this weapon, against other people, to use that weapon against other people. And because of her desire to have a weapon like that and to believe that she has control and authority over it, she has the hubris that causes the mistake to happen that loses all of these lives and causes all of the events of the first film to unfold. And in this movie, there is that hubris of this experiment on this thing that the US government found and they're responsible for, and Amanda Waller sends them in to destroy it, and the mission is really to destroy it no matter what and all evidence. And, you know, it's taken to that extreme where it's just like, but that is very similar to what's going on in the first one, of like, you wanted a weapon and it got out of your hands, you're out of your control, and so now you need to destroy the weapon and you send this team in to do it. And I would have preferred, in my opinion, a situation where they were going in to fight something where it wasn't actually the result of something Amanda Waller had her hands in.
Yeah, because you've got these cynical superhero bad guy, good guys, and then they become more cynical because they realize that their mission is not actually for the benefit of the world. It's for, you know, selfish needs or whatever. Like, you can't put a cynical hat on a cynical hat. Like, that's too much cynicism.
Yeah, and if you're going to do that, then there needs to be some sort of commentary on that between the two films. And I know there aren't very many characters left alive at the end of this film that were alive in the previous film, but there are more than enough in order to have some kind of commentary on it, to be able to say, like, oh, hey, this is actually bad. Like, your team is out here cleaning up these mistakes that are a part of your power grab. Like, at some point, this is all just, you know, because of you. And
yeah. Whatever name Waller's organization, it's like, if SHIELD was run by like a half dozen graduate students or something, like, they're so bad at this that all they can do is threaten inmates to gear up and go fight stuff, but they keep screwing up so badly that they're causing, I mean, there's not even like a comment that like they're causing the issues and then solving the problem so that they always have a job or whatever. Like, they're not creating the problem that they're solving, you know, to make the world think that there's a larger need for her services than there actually are. It's literally just their incompetence.
Yeah. And I don't find that incredibly satisfying. I know where James Gunn was trying to go with a commentary on U.S. geopolitical issues and our, you know, desire to have weapons and wield war against others.
Swordfish. That's the movie I was thinking of.
Well, this is Starfish.
I know, it's, but there's not a swordfish character going like, yes, we are terrorists, but we exist so that the government continue to fund their war against terror. Like, we have to be the bad, we're proactively being the bad guys so that we can also be the good guys. Like, it's not that. They're just like, whoops-a-daisy, we made a giant starfish and we hid it in a cylinder in South America.
They didn't make the giant starfish. They found the giant starfish.
They found a big starfish and then they fed it human beings until it became giant starfish.
Yeah, I don't really clearly, I just don't understand how that mechanism works. I know that Starro is a old-fashioned sort of comical villain of the DC universe.
But somebody saw Watchmen and went, LOL, look what we can do.
No, I mean, it's very, very old. What was it? The first appearance was in February of 1960. And this is just like a very, very old-fashioned, goofy kind of thing.
Did the original one poop baby versions of itself out of its armpits?
I don't know. I didn't read the comic in the 1960s.
I think that was the most gross thing in the movie. Like, little, you know, never mind people's faces exploding or whatever. Like, I didn't want to see a CG starfish pooping out baby starfishes from its armpit.
Well, I mean, do you know that that's its anus?
No, I don't know that that's its anus, but like, it's
the starfish is starfish, as it were.
It's
the starfish on your starfish.
It's still unpleasant to look at.
I mean, it wasn't great. No, especially like the long lingering shots when the building was destroyed, and you're just like staring up at it as they just slowly. I don't know.
There are several long reveal shots where you're watching it deploy its baby starfish. It's like, we understand. We saw it the very first time in the flashback footage on the space station or whatever.
Yeah, it's unpleasant. But to the there is also something super bleak about the way that they go into this situation, sort of similarly to the first one, because those. There were minions who were a byproduct of the central villain's sort of like taking over their bodies and converting them into her soldiers. And in this, the creature takes over their bodies and turns them into its soldiers. And so I don't like that. I would have also, again, preferred
but this
some
one
other mechanism.
Can communicate through the slave things, too.
No, I didn't find that very effective. And I really dislike any sort of thing where it's just like, oh, well, we can't save any of the people that have this, you know, the star on their face because they're completely converted now and they're just corpses underneath there. There's nothing you can do to save them without any sort of effort or time. Because what you're really saying is, we are not going to waste our characters' time on trying to save them because they are now cannon fodder. We just need to mow them down. And
casualties of war, bro. It all adds to the heartbreak of the government plots.
I really don't like that.
Nobody wins, man.
At the end of the film, they're celebrated as heroes on whatever weird international CNN they have going on, where they're talking about how they saved the day and they saved the country and whatever. And it's just like, actually, they killed a ton of people that did not need to die. And I don't know if this is necessarily a better outcome than if they had not gone to this island at all. I don't understand why you would do that from a storytelling perspective.
The new government regime would have had to figure out how to strategically deploy the giant starfish without destroying themselves, which seems like an effort that they would not have succeeded at.
Yeah, I mean, the first president, wanted to threaten to use it. Second bad guy president, he wanted to deploy it against the U.S. And like you said, there's very little chance of that happening. Obviously, he didn't know about all of the experimental data logs that were there, because if he had known about that, then they could have used that blackmail the United States or something. But that wasn't part of the plot at any point.
Just do what the quote-unquote good guys did and blackmail the government.
Yeah, and none of the villains seem to want to ask the thinker, how did you get this footage of the starfish thing on the space shuttle and then get the thing? because it seems like that would be an important step, is how did we come into possession of this thing? That none of the bad guys seem to want to ask that is very suspect. And from that moment on, I suspected that it was there because of the U.S. government, and that was the twist. But it makes everybody in the film also look really stupid. Why did we kill all these people? What was the point? Why do we celebrate our handful of bozos who survived the movie as heroes? What did they do that was super heroic? They finally killed the thing, but by doing this process, they killed, what, hundreds of people that didn't need to die? All the people who were in the streets were just innocent civilians that were all, like, murdered because of this process. They weren't the bad guy army guys who were initially caught up in that first wave of starfish things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It really bugs me on a certain level where it's just like any one of these particular things would be like a foible of the film. Like, oh, you know, I wish they hadn't done that. But it's like so many of these things add up by the end of this, you know, 132 minute movie where you're just like, why are we undercutting everything? Why are we killing everyone? Why are we destroying all of the things? Why is the twist the same kind of twist
really
as the other one?
What would happen if we had a giant starfish unleashed upon a city?
Yeah, well, they should have tried some hot dog flavored water, I guess. Or the chocolate star... I mean, is that what was it?
Yes. It was chocolate starfish and the hot dog flavored water.
Okay, thank you. Speaking of...
I didn't even get a Limp Bizkit song stuck in here with the pop culture and music, which they could have done.
Yeah, and this is a much more James Gunn assortment of music cues in here than we had in the previous Suicide Squad movie or in Birds of Prey,
where one guy was driving his little like van or whatever, Milton, mm-hmm. there's just like a song on the radio that probably cost them $50,000 to license just because that's James Gunn.
At first I wasn't sure where they were going with Milton, but then when Milton died I was like, oh, he was there to be the butt of this joke. That's kind of sad mm-hmm. and tragic. Poor Milton. Let's address some of the characters, air quotes, that are new to this project.
Right. So people who haven't watched this movie and aren't going to watch it, let's just, elaborate a little bit on what the beginning of this movie is. Like you mentioned, this movie is not in direct dialogue with the previous movie, but it's also not like trying to wipe the slate clean, but it sort of has a little bit of that, which, We see a suicide squad of people deployed to this island, and they just get absolutely wrecked and killed and destroyed, including, you know, Captain Boomerang, Pete Davidson. Who else is there from the old crew? But anybody? Nathan Fillion's there.
Yeah, but he wasn't the old crew. No. Just Harley is Harley Flag. Jai Courtney is Boomerang, and then a bunch of new people. Who are there?
Like eight other people, yeah. And all of them die except Flag and Harley, and we're not really sure what happened to Harley. And then, of course, why wouldn't you? We get a 3 days earlier graphic, and Miss Waller goes about setting up a second suicide squad so that there are two of them, and it turns out that this one, she claims, was a diversion to make it easier for the smaller team to sneak in the other side, but I don't know. I feel like it was just whichever one gets there faster. Like, she didn't really care because she sold it pretty well if she was setting these people up to die from the beginning.
It doesn't make any sense because she theoretically likes Flag, and she would have some faith in Harley Quinn being an actual, like, decent enough agent.
I'm going to send all these people to their death, but Flag is smart enough that he'll survive, and, you know, Harley maybe also.
But at no point does she say that. She's surprised when Flag is still alive and redirects the team to go get him. because she wants him alive, and that's the highest priority, and kill anybody else who gets in your way.
Or maybe she wants to kill Flag on the down low because Flag knows that she sent them in to be killed as distractions, and you got to close all your loose ends or whatever. But whatever it may be, the result is that we watch, what, 15 minutes of putting together a team. We don't spend as much time suffering through it like we did in the first movie, introducing every character. We just get a very long intro to Michael Rooker with weird long hair who kills a bird for no reason with a racquetball because he's a weirdo. And then all those people die, and you're like, hey, look at me. We subverted your expectations that we put together a team, and then they all just died. But then also, here's the real team. And you're like, great. I feel like I would have been less confused by the intro if I hadn't seen any of the trailers, which showed me some of these characters that are now dead, but then also some of the characters that weren't on the team. So it was like, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think James Gunn was like, it's like Alfred Hitchcock when he kills off Tippi Hedren in Psycho. And it's like, oh, the big name star of the film died. Ah, what a shock. And it's like, well, you know, Nathan Fillion's not like the big name star of the film.
He can detach his arms and then continue to use them for slapping and punching people while they float away.
I know why James Gunn wanted to gravitate towards that joke of how silly
you
that
do.
Yeah, because the character's silly, but at the same time, it's just like it's so ridiculous that it makes no sense in the film. I can buy why, I guess, the weasel is there, and, you know, all the other weirdos. I don't understand why Pete Davidson was able to make phone calls that informed this government that they were on their way. They don't really explain how he sold them out. I don't understand that mechanism. And Waller seems surprised by it rather than expecting it as part of the diversion, which is also strange. Because if she had really intended this to be a diversion, then maybe she would have foreseen that in some way and structured events differently so that her particular favorites could have survived. But it doesn't occur.
Yeah, it's also weird when we're watching it through the second team landing on the beach and there's the large explosion and they go like, oh, there's a bomb over here. She's like, don't worry about it, just a distraction. She seems like, when she's giving that line delivery, that the other team died 3 days ago. It doesn't seem like she's simultaneously managing both of these teams and freaking out that one of them is being blown up and then trying to calm down Idris Elba. It's just like, this doesn't totally work at all. Anyway, the result is just that, like, you know, oh, cool, we're in one of those movies where anybody can die at any given moment. Who cares? LOL, we're not really sure if anyone's dead or if nobody's dead or what's going to happen next or who cares. Just don't get invested because these are bad guys and they're expendable. I should have called this the Expendable Squad.
Well, Sylvester Stallone could have made another appearance in another Expendables product, I guess. But
yeah, he could have had his face shot off.
Yeah, so I don't like this beginning because, not because I liked any of these characters and wanted to invest in them, but because I feel like it wastes our time what is essentially a cruel joke that these are entirely disposable assets and that not only does Amanda Waller consider them disposable, but James Gunn considers them disposable.
And as a result, considers our time disposable slightly.
Yeah. And so at any moment, anyone you care about in the film could just croak. It happens in the film.
Don't get invested in Iron Man, kids. He might catch a bullet in the face randomly just because there's an LOL to be associated with it.
Yeah, and I found that really frustrating with Polka Dot Man when we get to the big finale battle, he gets crushed and killed unexpectedly, and it's not cathartic. I see because James Gunn has apparently commented on it, like he wanted to kill Ratcatcher 2 and leave Polka Dot Man alive, but then he decided he needed to flip that because he thought that Ratcatcher 2 is actually the heart of the film and that Polka Dot Man had completed his arc at that point. And I don't understand why he thought
that. Polka Dot Man had no arc. He was the butt of like one joke, and the funniest thing about him is when you just see his gigantic mom smashing the buildings.
Yeah, I mean, I,
But he's clearly just mentally ill. He doesn't have an arc. Yeah.
No, but I thought the stuff with his mom was very funny. All the little cutaways, like within the dance club and stuff. Like, there's visual humor to it. But he also seems like deeply affected by the trauma of everything in his life. But he did not need to die in that moment for the LOL of, oh, we just crushed one of our heroes in their moment of triumph. I don't feel like that helps anyone in the film, at all. And I did not really, you know, that had started to him. He had started to grow on me since, like, caring about whether or not Milton died, and, like, you know, seeing his mom, and, like, when he has his final triumphant moment of saying, "I'm a superhero now. I'm a, you know, bleeping superhero," and then he gets crushed. Like, you didn't need to undercut that moment like that. I disagree with it. And I feel like it would have been a much stronger film had he survived the events and had some sort of evolution because of that, that he does feel better about himself and he can perform, tasks in his life differently. And he is a more healed or well-rounded in some way person.
I mean, he's got an interdimensional disease that makes him glow and have to eject a bunch of polka dots twice a day, or he'll explode. I forget what he said the consequence of not relieving his polka dots would be.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just would have been nice if he felt like he had some purpose, and he did at the end, and then you killed him. And so it would be nice if he felt like he had some purpose and then got to go on to something else and use that purpose and feel like there was some sort of hope. I feel like undercutting that and saying, no, there's no hope.
He melted his giant mom's leg for a little bit, and that was his purpose.
Yeah, that was it. And I don't feel like that served the audience well. I like Ratcatcher 2.
For the audience, she was fun. The number 2, because... Yeah. Her father was Ratcatcher number 1, which was Taika Waititi, apparently.
Yes. The moment where they cut back to them talking about how rats are the lowliest creatures of the mole, it is just like, this is just strange, strange cutaway in the middle of this battle. I cared for her because she seemed to have this weird level of heart and friendship and understanding with these other, like, bloodthirsty macho people.
She's got a PlayStation VR wand or whatever, and she can control rats, and that's about it.
But I thought that actually was good. I thought that the way that they used her in the film was good. I don't understand why we could only do that with her, and that, like, everyone else needed to be this cynical sort of joke.
There's nothing good or redeemable inside a blood sport. He even told his own daughter, "Don't come to me for advice, young lady."
Yeah, so Bloodsport is kind of a tricky issue, because Bloodsport was supposed to be, what was his name, Deadshot?
Yeah.
Will Smith's character in the previous film, but he couldn't make it because he had scheduling conflicts. And so while he was attached to some of the earlier iterations of this in development, he was not attached to be in this. And in order to keep their release date and do all this other stuff, they had to bring in Idris Elba, but they didn't want to replace Will Smith's character in case he ever wanted to come back. So instead they had to use Bloodshot, which is Bloodsport, whatever.
Bloodshot, I think, is the name of that Vin Diesel movie where he's invincible.
Yeah. Well, that would have been an interesting casting choice. They had Idris Elba, and
he could have gone to South America and found a 70s, Dodge Charger to drive around in.
So Idris Elba was supposed to be he ends up being this replacement for Will Smith without being a replacement for Will Smith, because the character is on paper almost identical to the other character. And there is sort of a joke in here about it, about how you all have a unique set of skills, and it's like you could turn anything into a deadly weapon, and Peacemaker can turn anything into a deadly weapon. He's like, I thought you said it was supposed to be unique. And so, like, I kind of get that, but at the same time, Will Smith was arguably the, like, it was him and Margot Robbie who were, like, the main characters of the last film, and to not have him in this is okay. To not explain why he is not in this, but you have someone who is almost exactly the same in this is also weird.
Well, maybe he's just in a solitary confinement for a little while and he can't come out to play with the Suicide Squad.
Yeah, but you just say that. You just say, we can't. He's on some other mission. We can't.
Oh, but there's so many Suicide Squad people. You can't even name all of them. Like, we can't even get into that.
No, I just feel like they should have had some sort of line about how they can't deploy him on this for some reason. To not comment on it for the audience is strange, because then you're just like, is he just replacing Will Smith? He's got a suit and he's got guns and things, but like, is he the same?
He's got a cooler helmet though.
What you mean, like the H.R. Geiger helmet thing?
Yeah, it's cool.
I guess, but I mean, it also seemed kind of weird because it was just like, it's not like he has some sort of like organic skull theme, but for some reason he has that jaw. I thought it was interesting how all the stuff was like part of his, you know, suit that he could like put together and use and stuff. And so it wasn't just like a weapon that he fired. But at no point did you see that really differentiating him from Will Smith's character. And he is in the same sort of situation where he has to sort of gruffly defy authority in order to not just get things done, but to do the right things. And I don't feel like that sets him apart from Will Smith either. And so the only way they really tried to set him apart from Will Smith is, instead of having a great relationship with his daughter, he has a bad relationship with his daughter. And it's like, I don't...
Which could, I mean, Will Smith could have done that between the two movies. Like, they could have easily had that.
Yeah, so I don't understand what compelled them to do this. Because it's just like, could you, I don't know, make it a son or something? Like, why did it have to be a daughter to do the same sort of silly thing?
Well, his daughter is trying to follow in his footsteps of being a criminal.
Yeah, I have to confess, I know we're talking, I know you found it deeply unfunny, but I did actually kind of laugh at their scene where they're blowing up at each other and he's like, oh, you stole this stupid watch, got busted for it and stuff.
There were a couple of funny lines there. Who wants to watch TV on their watch? It does other things.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's something going on there, but I just, he doesn't develop into anything else. Like, his thing is he goes from being this cynical mercenary, just like Will Smith, to being a leader who does the right thing, just like Will Smith. And he has a moment of confrontation with Waller where he makes his own demands and his own rules. And it's just like, that's not super different from how things shook out in the last film. But I wanted some more there, because at the end, he like has the footage and stuff from Flag, and instead of releasing it to the world, he uses it to blackmail Waller so that he can get what he wants. And
which would have been a great turn for Will Smith too, because, you know, he's been stuck in this system or whatever since the first movie doing Waller's business, but now he's finally got a bargaining chip that he can use to try and sort of extract a little bit more freedom out of the situation for himself. Yeah.
And all she says is, I told you I'd make you a leader, and it's just like, no, like, no.
Touche. Blood and sport. old blood sport.
And your other main new characters are King Shark, which is very easy to summarize King Shark. It is like I Am Groot, but a shark.
A giant.
Yeah.
Sort of lovable moron who is ostensibly indestructible and eats human beings.
Yeah. I you know, you could say he's more fun than Killer Croc or something, because he basically stands in that spot of having something that is sort of this anthropomorphic part human, part animal kind of thing. And I guess, but he's
got the brain of an 8-year-old and likes to eat people.
Yeah, there's no character there to develop, and he's not very complicated. You have what may be the most, I wouldn't say complicated character, but the peacemaker, the most not straightforward character, or too straightforward, or straightforward but with a plot twist. I don't know.
Is there a name for a double agent who's working for the same side but also has ulterior motives?
A half double agent?
He's like, oh yeah, one and a half agent. Or would it be like a three over two? Well, it's still 1.5.
You ever see, I know you haven't watched LA Story, but have you ever seen where they're going around taking the sort of coffee order for the table and be like, I'll have a half twist, I'll have a half calf, and I'll have a half calf with a half twist, and then it was I'll have a double decaf, half calf. It's just like all these like sort of mixes of parts of things. I just feel like that's sort of what he winds up being, is like he's sort of your turns out, but he's also exactly what you would expect him to be, where he is committed to doing the things, and he broadcasts that through the whole film. So it's not
a hilarious indictment of American ideology, because he believes in liberty and freedom and, you know, saving America, and he's going to shoot people directly in the face because it makes him feel good to do that for liberty purposes. He's a horrible man who does things in the name of patriotism.
Yeah, I mean, he's this sort of indictment of Captain America, where it's just like taken to the satirical extreme, where no matter what it is, it's justified because it's about liberty, and you can be anything can be explained away in the pursuit of this, and that the way he speaks to people is demeaning, and, you know, coarse, and it's all centered from this sort of power he feels that he has, as this person. And I would say that really the only redeeming quality about it is that John Cena's playing the character. 'Cause I feel like John Cena is, in a lot of comedy films, but I don't think people think of him as being good at comedy. But I think that he's actually very good at comedy, because he can always play anything straight, which is not entirely easy to do with some of the more ridiculous lines that you are given to say. Mm. So he can say it straight, but also have complete and total faith in what he's saying. So when they're on the beach, and then he has his first little spat with Idris Elba as they're going inland, and Idris Elba's like, "Yo, would you eat a ladies and gentlemen, I'm gonna curse here, would you eat a bag of dicks for your country?" And he says, this whole beach was covered in dicks, I'd eat the everything on the beach. And it's just like, it's so weird, it's such a weird thing to say, and like Idris Elba's reactions to it in the moment are pretty genuine in terms of like, why would you say that? And the way John Cena sells it is that he is completely sincere in what he is saying, and that his character has this faith in what he what he believes that he would do
anything
for
old glory, whether that's shooting children in the face or eating a beach full of dicks,
or wearing some tidy whities to sleep in.
What do you suppose that helmet really was about there? He says it's not a toilet seat, it's a beacon of freedom or whatever, but...
I have no idea. I really am curious. I don't mind... the helmet itself being metal or chrome or whatever, that doesn't bother me as much as, like, the sort of band part that protrudes around it. I don't understand what the horseshoe
shape connects
the
front to the back of it, because he couldn't get it made out of like a single unibody piece of metal.
Oh, they had to stamp it and then put them together, and that's the mold line.
It's the weld, mold line or the weld edge or something.
It's just like a green army man.
Exactly
the edge. So I don't know. I mean, it got a lot less fun when he had to turn and be the bad guy, and his fight with Flag and his pursuit of Ratcatcher. I didn't enjoy that.
His pursuit of Ratcatcher. I just want to point out that you said that.
Yeah, and it, like, I did, you know, there was something sort of like nice in the final comeuppance, where he gets shot with the bullet that's tinier than the other bullet, so it goes through the bullet and then kills him. But he doesn't die in the post credit scene. It is revealed that he is alive, because he will be in a television series for HBO Max called The Peacemaker, and it's going to have him and Steve Agee, who was the the tall beardy guy in the control room, and the blonde lady who was in the control room, who have names in the cast list, but are not really elaborated on in terms of like doing anything. You wind up in a situation with this film where you also have Amanda Waller basically being Amanda Waller. And I feel like while the first one underutilized Viola Davis to a criminal degree, this one is like a felony, several felonies. I don't understand.
Several felonies stacked on top of each other in a trench coat.
Yeah, the real Suicide Squad is what you did to Viola Davis's career with this. Because I feel like she is such a capable actress and a consummate professional that she does what she's asked to do. But what she is asked to do is so beneath what her actual talent level is that I am sort of aghast that James Gunn wouldn't give her more of a role here, more to do, more to articulate, more to say. Instead, she
stare sort of directly at the camera with a wide angle lens 2 inches from her face.
She's just this taskmaster, this brutal enforcer of rules that she makes, and she has all of her duplicitous backstabbing stuff.
She's also working on her short game because she's got golf with the boys this weekend, and she's gonna get killed because she's bad at putting, and that prop's not gonna come back later to whack her upside the head when she's trying to kill all the good bad guys.
I actually, I will say that while I didn't think it was funny to hit her over the head with the golf club, to knock her out, I did like that she was knocked out and they defied her and they did the thing, because in the previous movie she killed all of her subordinates.
And maybe they all know that.
Yeah, so I kind of like that this movie does get back at her sort of for that. I don't know what happens to the subordinate who hit her, because she's not featured at the end of the film, so maybe she went away to die somewhere off screen. But
I mean, the way Waller sort of looking through the window at the crew after talking to Bloodsport, whatever, she's kind of looking like, well, you know, they defied me, but they did the right thing out there or something. Like, she gives a look like she's not, like, they're all, you know, slightly at odds with one another. Not like, she's like the weird kid out who's being excluded from the party now. Not really the leader who could shoot them all down with impunity, because that's what she did in the first movie.
Yeah. I kind of don't like this, because she doesn't have any opportunity to grow here as a character. She doesn't feel any remorse or guilt. She's not going to lose any sleep tonight because if a bunch of people died because of her actions. So they have to knock her out to take her out of the picture so that they can do the right thing, which she would not do. And I would like to see something with her where you're just like, okay, so is it that she's always going to do this? That, like, no matter what, it's the mission and she's going to kill everyone? Or is her character growing in any way? Does she have any sorts of concerns? I think maybe something that you should do, well, not you specifically, unless you're making Suicide Squad 3 or the Suicide Squad or the Suicide Squad or Two Suicide, Two Squad. I don't know. I don't know what numbering system they're going to have for this. Or maybe they're just going to go with like colons and it'll be like Suicide Squad :. And so whatever they decide, if they have a sequel to this with Amanda Waller, maybe what you need to do is to put someone above Amanda Waller who is actually terrible. And so that gives her some way to act off of something else other than just barking orders from a control room.
Well, the whole point is that she reports to nobody, so she can do whatever she wants or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just give her like a bad president or something. Give her something. Like, I feel like just having her be in a control room without any accountability, just barking stuff with her double, triple turns out backstabbing, it isn't that interesting a use of Viola Davis's talents as an actress. And if you aren't going to use her, like, why have her? To be honest with you, I feel like it's sort of a waste.
Yeah. Here's a slightly off topic, but maybe we'll come back to the topic question that I don't know if there's an answer to. Is there an in-universe, like, time period that we're meant to understand? Like, is this supposed to be present day in these movies, or is it the past a little bit, or future a little bit? Do you have any idea?
Oh, that's such a charming question, Dan. this is a DC movie. Its timeline is whatever. I feel like it is supposed to be around our current time. Mm. However, because the events of things that occur inside of the DC film universe are not exactly mirrored to the events of things that happen in our real timeline, I don't feel like it is necessarily one-to-one. And there is also frighteningly little consistency between these films about what the time is. So I don't even know if you could say between them what is really happening.
Sure. I mean, maybe this is sort of related to my general feeling that the people in charge, Waller and her team, are basically inept newbies, whether it be the mission or how they're running it or whatever. There's a kind of a shockingly minimal use of technology in the movie beyond, like, explosives in people's neck and satellites or whatever. Aside from the titular squad members who have their futuristic guns and stuff, like, the government operatives don't appear to have any sort of, you know, technology that would allow them to, you know, hold the squad folk down should they become, against their captors or whatever. Like, she can just blow them up. She doesn't have, like, she doesn't have a helicarrier. So I'm not saying that she needs to or anything, but, like, you know, that's a big difference between the Marvel version, where we feel like S.H.I.E.L.D. kind of is always, whether they're just doing hand wavy nonsense, it kind of feels like S.H.I.E.L.D.'s a couple steps ahead of everyone in the movie, and they need to be. Whereas in this movie, and the previous Suicide Squad movie, the entire movie exists because, whoopsie daisy, they didn't see the consequences of their actions, and now we have to make up for it.
Yeah. And
does that bother you, though? Does the technology issue bother you, or is that just me?
The technology doesn't really bother me because it feels so flimsy. Just like, this isn't connected to, like, Earth as we know it. The place where they are, Corto Maltese, that's not real. Like, they just, like, invent things. The city that they fought their battle in last time, not a real city. Just, like, parts of the Chicago skyline and stuff, in random places in Toronto. So it can just, whatever they're doing, it just sort of is this flexible whatever background pastiche of things. Yeah,
which is probably one of the other reasons it feels so disposable, because it's not grounded in anything that we give a crap about. Not saying that every movie has to imperil New York City and, you know, we have to see, you know, a corner coffee shop lady in fear for her life from some alien and have our hero swoop in and save her or whatever. But I don't know. I feel like it's just one of the many things that contributes to us not giving a crap about this movie.
I think that's one of the problems. I think that's also a problem for Marvel films, where it is New York or someplace we do give a crap about, is that if you are just going to kill a bunch of people en masse, and it's supposed to be because it's someplace that you can envision in your mind, or you have friends or something that's there, and so you have some sort of connection to it in the real world. At a certain point, you don't have that connection because it's so goofy with aliens and beams and stuff that it doesn't mean anything that you're killing all of New York or whatever. What I find is more compelling is when it's at either a smaller scale or it involves, you know, like the consequences of doing these things that are en masse, but with the conflict being between characters that we know or care about, and to give us that drama. Like, Starro is not a character. Starro has no real conflict with our team or knowledge of them or any connection to them. Starro is just a monster thing. And you can't have that sort of relationship where it matters what Starro is doing because of some sort of previous history. And there is no previous history with any of this stuff.
Floating around looking at the stars until we ruined its life and brought it down to Earth.
Yeah, whatever. It doesn't mean anything. Like,
we made Starro into this monster.
No, not really. Starro didn't need to like take over the minds of everybody on the shuttle.
Actually, to be honest, we didn't torture Starro. We tortured people with Starro. So,
well, all the people who have Starro stars on their faces are extensions of Starro. So you were torturing Starro every time you tortured them.
Well, was that a torture for Starro, or were you like powering up Starro because he got bigger and he got more slaves to control? But like, we don't have any evidence that we harmed Starro aside from making it, putting it in jail for, 30 years or whatever.
Well, I think Starro was a little upset at the thinker, Gaius Greaves. And
Dr. Lightbulb Head.
Yeah. Played by Peter Capaldi, who is probably more well known for his role as Doctor Who. The Doctor, sorry. But he is sort of this evil, I guess, version of the Doctor in this role that he has as the Thinker.
He has a couple of funny lines, then he makes some funny faces, and then gives some exposition, and then he dies.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say it's as criminal of an underuse of an actor as it is with Viola Davis, but it is just kind of like a charmless use of him, where I feel like he can affect a greater range of emotions in a role than what is here. But I you can only have so much screen time, and I'd rather they spend it on our main characters than him. But he does get something. Particularly when Ratcatcher threatens him with the what is it, like a bunch of rats up your ass, and how would you like that? And then he says, I don't think you really want to know the answer to that question.
Oh dear.
Yeah. But I don't know. It doesn't bother me so much that he's disposable, as much as it bothers me that all of the main cast is disposable. So whatever. I didn't need him to grow and learn a lesson or anything. But I needed our heroes too, and I needed some sort of conflict between a villain who made sense, and instead of like just some monster thing.
Well, the villain was America all along.
Yeah, but it isn't. They're not fighting against Amanda Waller, because Amanda Waller is conveniently sidelined, and so they're fighting against Starro.
They're tacitly fighting against Amanda Waller by doing the opposite of what she ordered to help other people.
Yeah, if you really cared about me, you wouldn't be disobeying me. I guess. I don't know. It feels so silly and, like, wasteful.
Is it weird that we're asking for a superhero movie just to be a little bit more boring and not have quite so many double crosses and just, like, send a group of weirdo people who don't get along to a place to go fight a bad guy?
No, I mean, I'd like to stress this. I don't care that there are turns out or double turns out or twists. Like, you can have as many of those as you want to. I want to care about the characters involved in those double turns out and twists. If I don't care about the characters, then it doesn't matter how many times you twist it around. Then it's not as affecting for me on any sort of emotional level. You're just doing plot mechanic things, which sound interesting in an outline or summary format, but are less compelling to me as a person watching your movie trying to invest in the characters on screen. Does that make sense as a complaint?
I think so.
Okay. So, like, I don't care that Peacemaker betrays Flag, but, like, I don't care if Flag dies other than why'd you kill him? And I don't care if Flag lives.
We've never gotten to appreciate or care about Flag long enough to give a crap if he dies.
Yeah, I mean, they tried to give us something where it's like, oh, he wouldn't leave behind Harley. They've been through so much, whatever. And it's just like, have they? Do they? Does it matter to anyone? Like, what is that thing? What is that connection? They barely talk to each other in terms of, like, screen time. Joel Kinnaman is not really playing his previous role, and he doesn't, like we said, doesn't comment on his girlfriend or former girlfriend of the previous picture, who was the villain. And those things could be relevant things to build off of, but instead he's just sort of this less bad than Peacemaker, but not as mean as Bloodsport, like, character. I don't know. It's this weird in-between.
Somebody should have made a joke to Flag saying, try not to fall in love with the giant starfish monster.
Oh, yeah. See, that would have been funny. You could have been commenting you could have been commenting on his character history or something.
Mm-hmm.
But and that wouldn't necessarily require the audience to have seen the first film, but it would have provided something for people who had gone through the effort of spending several hours of their lives on this crap.
Reward us, James Gunn.
Yeah, I cater to me, cater to my whims. but I just
not a lick of fan service in this movie, is there?
Well, I mean, it's just sort of like anti fan service, I guess.
Oh yeah, you're a fan of Suicide Squad? F you, we're gonna kill them all.
Oh, you think you like Suicide Squad? Well, watch all these dead people now. They're all dead. Like, I don't know. I just give me something emotionally that I could care about. In the course of events that are going on here, because I don't care about Bloodsport's daughter. I don't care at all about that reveal at the end where we cut back to her inside of, I guess it's her foster home, and is on the weird CNN that they all seem to be watching at the time. It's like breaking news. The star monster on this the tiny island nation you've never heard of has been destroyed by this one guy we've identified from helicopter footage from, where was the helicopter? I don't know. But it's just like this thing of just like, oh yeah, remember that as being a conflict in this film? That's our character resolution. We're all done now. And her thinking, oh, my dad really is a hero. I bet it turns her life around or something. Who cares? She's not really a character. It troubles me that that sort of gets grafted on there. Like I said earlier, I think they did a much better job with Ratcatcher. Although, like, it was very heavy-handed when they cut to the Taika Waititi thing on top of the building. I feel like they gave her something where her sort of weird optimism and desire for friendship not necessarily being, like, the most lethal or most bloodthirsty or most greedy or most anything, really, worked in her favor. But at the end of this, she's still on this team. And it doesn't feel as satisfying because Idris Elba really is sort of fixing his relationship with the rat by finally reluctantly petting the CG rat. He's not fixing his relationship with Ratcatcher. And it's sort of an odd thing to do in terms of character building.
It's his growth, though, man. He can touch the rat that he's afraid of for some unknown reason.
Yeah, and King Shark isn't eating Ratcatcher, even though she's constantly sleeping, which is, I guess, good.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things, not to keep harping on, like, what is the disconnect here between this and the Marvel world, but, like, does this movie have what you would describe as, like, a competent adult figure? Like, you don't have, like, debatably, Marvel has Iron Man and Captain America who have differing ideologies, but they're both kind of, like, smart people pursuing a path that they believe is correct. And in this movie and in the other Suicide Squad movie, it's mostly just like screw ups and like people try and stuff, but there's nobody like with a plan in charge who really like you believe they have any idea what they're doing.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the, unfortunately, I think this may be a point where you're just going to have to agree to disagree with Suicide Squad, but it is basically a squad of screw ups.
Sure, but like even in the government team or whatever, none of them feel like they have it together. Waller.
Yeah, I think that is probably a better point you're making is that on the government side of things, it feels worse because then you have idiots being led by idiots as opposed to.
Remember the first movie where there was a guy in like a general suit who's sitting around a conference table who just loudly shouts, I thought this was contained for some reason. And they just cut that in. You're like, well, That's okay. I'm glad you had that guy yell that line and we cut it there. So that's great.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have David Harbour. Was he busy? I don't know. But
oh, yeah, he didn't get a steak scene.
Yeah, I mean, no steak. No steak in this movie. Mm. No steak, Jerry. But it is so, frustrating that it doesn't feel, I mean, I can understand, you know, if you're trying to say like, oh, there is no like easy answer to things or there is no pat solution to things or whatever. But that's not really what the movie is saying. The movie is saying
it's complicated. There's no easy answers is what the movie is saying. But a movie is supposed to be entertaining and have a message and something clear enough for us to understand and care about.
Yeah, I would say that the some of the comedy in this film is better than the comedy in the previous film.
Sure. I think it should. I mean, I feel like it should go without saying that James Gunn did a more competent job than Ayer did. Like, this is a better movie than the first one. Which is not a high bar.
I feel like I'm looking at.
I shouldn't have said better. I should have said more entertaining.
Yeah, I feel like I'm looking at two very bruised pieces of fruit that are damaged in different ways, and I'm being asked to eat one of them. And it's just like they have different problems, and so I don't necessarily think either one of these is good. I feel like Ayer's had very little to it. It was also much shorter. This has more going on, but is more with about the same level of substance. And it goes on for longer, although it doesn't feel like it drags as much in many of the points as it did in the first one, even though that's shorter. So it's a sort of like oddly imbalanced between the two. And sort of the visual distinctiveness of things between them is obviously different. But they have different problems. And like some, while I was just talking about how I feel like some of the stuff in this movie is funnier, there's also stuff in here that's supposed to be funny that I found really sort of dark and not entertaining to me, but I understand the impulse to label it as comedy. Like when Waller orders them to go to Flag's position because it just came online and kill everybody that's there because they're all enemies. It's the top priority is to get Flag out. So then they proceed to murder the entire like encampment that's there of people who obviously seem like they are not part of the government. And they just sort of have this competition to see in what sort of like humorous ways they can kill all of the people who were there and barely noticing that all of this murder is happening before they finally have the reveal that, oh yeah, these are the freedom fighters and they've agreed to help us. And why are you guys here? What's going on here? And then the joke is that they killed all the freedom fighters. I don't like that. I found that to, because it's too dark and too bleak for us to bounce back from with levity, and it's also too dismissive of human life while they're murdering all of them. Like, they're not
You don't have to worry about it, though, because you completely forget about all the freedom fighters until the last part of the movie where they're on CNN saying, we're going to have elections.
Yeah, I love that announcement, by the way. We are going to have the first democratic elections in the history of this country. And it's like, today? Like, what? You got some other stuff going on.
The fires first, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, like,
just pull all the bodies out of the rubble?
Yeah, nobody really, there's no, like, big democracy switch that you throw when you're overthrowing a dictatorship. So I don't necessarily understand why that was thrown in there, other than to make it seem like they did something that was good in such a broadly cartoonish fashion of, like, American imperialism, but it was peculiar. Why kill all of them? Like, why have them agree to go along anyways? Because it's a necessary good that they do that. Like, that the joke, like, so hampers all the rest of the stuff that's going on that I don't feel like it's worth making that joke. because it's also not funny. But that's just, you know, the kind of thing where that obviously was entertaining to James Gunn. Like, oh, what if they accidentally kill all the people that could actually help them? And it's like, LOL. It's like, but that just makes everyone look like idiots. Sure, LOL.
Are idiots because they're just prisoners who are out here doing a job that they're unfit for. So get it?
Mm-hmm. And I also found stuff like really distracting whenever it was like Jotunheim, and it's just like, why is it called that? Why are we calling it that? We are not anywhere near any of the Scandinavian or Germanic countries or anything really that would be going through that route. And then it's like, oh well, that was actually a secret Nazi base. And it's like, what does that have to do with the shuttle that had the starfish on it?
It's also half a syllable away from a Marvel thing from the Thor universe.
Well, I mean, it is Jotunheim. It's the name of the same name is used, but yeah, it means different things.
They pronounce it they hit the T a little harder in this one.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, and with something like Harley, like we talked about, they wasted opportunity to have any sort of connection between the previous films, plural, that she's been in. But in this one, they also have her comedy isn't the same comedy as the other movies that she was in, which is a strange choice, I feel like. It doesn't seem like she's...
her sort of like bubbly psychosis and voices in her head kind of stuff?
Yeah, which she had more of in the first one. Mm-hmm. And in this, Birds of Prey, she had sort of a different humor vibe going on. In this one, she has something else completely different, where she's got the delusions as a visual representation, which we saw some of in the previous films, but it's depicted differently here. And she also has these misunderstandings of things, and that's what generates some comedy, but she just kind of like weaves in between them and like murdering people, but she doesn't say anything else really that has the same emotional connection to anything like it did in Birds of Prey, to what else is happening in the scene. I don't know. I think I'm maybe, I'm not trying to like rank Birds of Prey very highly, but I feel like they treated Harley in a more, as a more well-rounded character than James Gunn did.
Yeah. She seemed more like, Harley Quinn, and here she seems like a Joss Whedon character.
Yeah. And I didn't necessarily love that choice. So as far as like comedy goes, like it was sort of distracting whenever she would just like be funny for funny's sake. Like I thought it was kind of funny when she, you know, she's greeted and she says gracias. you know, the weird sort of I forget the dialect. The sort of strange regional Spanish dialect choice for that moment. And then you also had like when she murders the president and has her like whole like red flag thing, you know, and I thought that was, you know, good. And that monster between your legs or whatever, like it was weird. And I don't necessarily feel like the character of Harley Quinn is so perfectly well defined that you can't revisit it in some way, but I feel like you need to sort of like build something better if you're going to like do something different. And I don't feel like they did anything really different or better. Just sort of like reshuffle things. Movie. Yeah. Which was an odd choice with the combat boots and stuff, but they sort of seemed to have like a visual thing they wanted to go for. So anyway, I don't know. I'm kind of like down on this perhaps more than many other people are, because it seems like this was much more positively reviewed by critics. But I feel like maybe the critics had a lower bar than maybe we have. Where if you're just comparing this, I guess, to other Warner Brothers movies, you might be like, great. It has this middle and the beginning and an end and everything. But I don't know. It just doesn't seem to satisfy me.
No.
Yeah. You know, is there anything else?
That's my review. I don't know. I think our rambling discussion of the movie is just as scattershot as the film itself. So great. It's It's on HBO Max. If you want to go watch it and have some James Gunn-esque fun in a different franchise other than Guardians and Marvel. So it's there for you.
Yep.
I don't feel like it contributes anything to the universe or the canon of these characters or whatever, but
I do kind of. Okay, I'll be honest with you. I had no plan to watch Suicide Squad, Birds of Prey, or The Suicide Squad. Mm-hmm. And then we were looking for something to do, and then it was the release day for The Suicide Squad, and then we came up with this half-butted plan of we will just do these three. And I don't feel like that has rewarded me in any meaningful sense, but it has helped me, I think, perhaps articulate what it is that I don't like about these films in a way where I was just an outsider looking at these films going, I'm not going to watch that. Yeah. Now I'm like, I'll tell you why I won't watch this.
And, you know, at the end of the day, it probably beats watching another Affleck Batman movie or a Superman movie. But yeah, you get a view of what DC is trying to do and how they're scrambling these days. But yeah, it's it just, again, like I said at the beginning, it brings me back to the days where we didn't really know how to make superhero movies, and we were just kind of trying stuff, and they didn't really work out all that well, and they weren't terribly satisfying, but we just kept making them, and now we have bigger budgets and flashier stuff and quippier jokes.
Yeah, I really, I don't know. I just feel like DC doesn't really have a sense of what to do. As we've discussed, there's just nothing coherent in terms of like a brand strategy, and that seems to be really what their desire is brand, not so much any particular artistic effort. And that is to the detriment of all parties involved. It is merciful that they didn't incorporate any other DC properties in this to try to like weave it in there like they did in the first one. Because I feel like that was a real error. Because
the Batman cameos?
Yeah, the Batman cameos were awful. And the Joker was the worst rendition of a Joker to be in a film.
Well, they did say that Bloodshot Sport, whatever, was in prison for putting Superman in the ICU with a kryptonite bullet, which he got who knows where.
Yeah. I mean, but like that being a line of dialogue, I'm fine with. Just having these people be on the screen to sort of like tie it in visually would have been an issue. I don't feel like Warner Brothers doesn't know what it's doing. It's just all a bunch of random stuff that just comes out, and like things are in development hell and then they're greenlit, and then that affects all this other stuff, and then other stuff was released at the same time, so we got to revisit what we were doing for this other thing. Like it's just such a train wreck.
Maybe they'll give us a movie to direct.
Yeah, I'm sure. Comments we've had. Yeah.
Well, we have specific and actionable criticism that I think we could really, implement and solve some issues for him.
I don't know. Actionable doesn't really seem like a...
Well, you just use the words in the meetings. We'll be okay.
Yeah. So we're just going to pitch to you guys our take on the Suicide Squad, where they're competent and good stuff happens. Anyway, it's also worth noting that this is one of the first. It is one of several DC movies that have been released under the day and date release strategy that went into effect because of COVID-19. And this movie only made $140 million at the box office on a budget of $185 million. And I don't need to do the math on that for you guys to know that there is also a lot more money that was spent on things that are not reflected in that budget, like marketing. So this was not a moneymaker for anybody. But at the same time, I feel like this is weirdly viewed as being more successful than something like Birds of Prey, where it also just basically like met the budget for what it was in 2020. And the director of that received a lot of, I would say, some flack for it underperforming, whereas I don't feel like anybody's giving James Gunn any guff over the performance of this at the box office.
Well, can't be James Gunn's fault because he did very successful movies.
Also, he's a man, so he's got that going for him.
Wow. Just come right out with it, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, well, I hate to insinuate that there is some misogyny involved in the way that we talk about success and failure in these sorts of endeavors, but it's possible that could be taking place. But anyway, you know, let's just keep going. We'll have the Peacemaker series and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. We found a. Found a mini disc or something, whatever they decide to do.
Yeah, I saw you talking about mini disc players the other day. I had one at one point. Somebody gave it to me as a gift, but it was like a used open box at Best Buy, so it came in like a giant Ziploc bag. It was really weird. I think I might still have it here. I should probably mail it to you.
I don't. Why do you think I want one?
You said you really seemed like you wanted one when you were tweeting about it the other day.
Well, the YouTube algorithm surfaced a relatively long video about the history of the mini disc, which contained a lot of stuff that I didn't actually know about in terms of like the format wars with like DCC tape and all kinds of stuff. But it was one of the things when I was a kid teen, and I kind of wanted one because it seemed futuristic and neat and cool and whatever. Because magneto optical discs, who didn't want one?
But it's like a CD but tinier and cooler looking.
Also you could to flip the bits. What was the magneto optical one that was before the zip drive? I can't remember the name of it, but it was a data disc format thing. It didn't survive for very long, but it was just one of those things where just like data storage formats in the 90s were bonkers. And I always thought that was interesting, and you would see all this cool stuff that the mini disc player could do, but the mini disc format and thing by itself, like, it was so ill-timed to the needs of the world that it also was an attempt to sort of create and dominate a market by Sony, which is always one of the funnier things that Sony does, like. Memory stick Pro Duo, all those things.
Purple just, gum sticks.
Yeah, it's just like you guys, nobody wants your baloney here.
You can put them in MP3 players. You can put them in cameras.
Yeah, yeah, it was a huge success. Nobody wants the stuff. So anyway, it was just a fun thing to watch. I do not want a mini disc player, but it does seem like the kind of thing that where. in terms of the stale medium that they what was it? It was the end of Guardians of the Galaxy 2. He finds a Zune at some market or something. That's
right.
What it was.
Or doesn't somebody gift him a Zune?
Yeah, it's a Zune. Because that's the funnier thing than an iPod. But so no mini disc. It'll be a Zune. Maybe he'll put the mini disc in the Peacemaker TV show. Who knows? He seems to gravitate to these sorts of weird musical formats. And on that note,
yeah.
Eject.